Okay, listen, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Ecclesiastes. We left off in chapter 4, and keep something in mind. When we're reading this this book, you've got to understand where Solomon is coming from, because I think like 37, 39 times throughout the book, he talks about this. He uses this phrase, under the sun. And that's where you've got to look at where he's coming from. He's just looking at life from a horizontal perspective. And a lot of times, if that's all you look at life from, then you come to a lot of dead ends in your worldview. Because let's just face it, just stop and think about it for a minute. I mean, if there is no God and then this life is the end and all of everything, then let's face it, there is no purpose to it. There isn't, is there? There's not a person in this room and there's not a person in this world that can convince me otherwise that there is real purpose to life if there's no prime mover behind it, our existence. You see what I'm saying? So anyway, that's basically what Solomon was doing. He was looking at life from that plane. And beginning with verse 1 in chapter 4, he says that, "Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression that were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them, and on the side of the oppressor was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." Now, see, what he's saying here, it really flies in the face of a lot of, let's say, our traditional type of thinking. Because if you're looking at it, you know, some of it almost stands in stark contrast to what we would believe as Christians. But let me just break it down for a minute. He says, "Then I looked again at the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them." Now, he's taking a look at what's going on in the world. Look what's going on in our world today. Like, we live in a country where we have virtually no concept of what it is to be oppressed. I mean, we really don't. I mean, we as Westerners, especially as Americans, we've never lived under, you know, a tyranny. We've never lived under a despot like Saddam Hussein or Joseph Stalin or, you know, Lenin or Mao Zedong or Castro. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. You know, we've never lived under that kind of terror. But I tell you, I've done a lot of reading as far as the torture and the torment and the killing and the executions and everything that went on, let's say, in the Soviet Union and in China, you know, under the communists. The communists are responsible for virtually 100 million deaths, 100 million murders when they took over. And they took over in 1917 under Lenin. You know, he got all of his fancy ideas from Marx. And he decided he was going to put it into practice. But you see, here's the thing. It's like when men set out to try to build a utopia, which this is what the communists did. They decided they were going to build this workers' paradise where, you know, everybody was going to be equal. Everything was going to be shared in common. There was going to be no capitalism or any kind of thing like that. People were just going to, all the workers were going to unite the world in the world, and then everybody was going to basically lift everyone else up. But here's the thing. It's a good idea in theory. As a matter of fact, you can go back to the book of Acts and you can find a form of communism. Go back to the book of Acts. We are told that in the early church, there was a number of people who would end up selling their homes or their possessions or their property or whatnot. And then they would give it over to the apostles. They would share it all in common. And so people just had a situation where there were no poor. And because, you know, people were just volunteering their property or their money to help other people out. Well, that's, in a sense, that was a form of communism, but that was done totally on a volunteer basis, right? Well, when the communists, they took over, everything was done under the gun. There was no volunteering. I mean, it was just an oppressive situation. But here's what made it so oppressive, is they did away with God. They wanted to build a utopia apart from God. They mocked anybody who believed in God. When the communists took over, they completely tore down all the churches and the mosques and the synagogues. They just tore them up. They turned churches into latrines. They turned them into libraries. They turned them into gymnasiums. They turned them into indoor swimming pools. You know, they just completely stifled any belief in God whatsoever. And if you were a Christian, if you were a pastor, if we had a Bible study like this, I could go to jail. The rest of you could be locked up. I mean, you know, this is what oppression is, all right? And these people, you know, are responsible for millions and millions and millions of people dying. This is what happens when men try to be autonomous for God or set up a government, a world government apart from God. They become oppressors. But interesting thing, look at the way he says here. Then I looked at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw all the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And then on the side of the oppressors was the power, but they had no one to comfort them. Do you know what that means? In other words, the oppressors had no one to comfort them. And I read this book by John Toll, and it's called Adolf Hitler. It's a very thick book, but I remember in the book, Hitler, you know, he completely took over Germany, and he made it a very oppressive regime. And he was killing people by the millions in his final solution. But he was also tormented by demons. I read episodes where he would just wake up in the middle of the night, he'd be breaking out in a sweat, and he'd be yelling to, you know, his attendants, and he says, "There he is, there he is." He'd actually be seeing demons, this guy. And, you know, they would have to calm him down with medication and everything like that. But he was a very oppressed man in many respects, because he sold himself out to evil to that point where, you know, he became oppressed. Same thing with Stalin. I don't know if too many of you have heard of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I read his book, The Gulag Archipelago. And in that, he talks about how they had this just massive prison. Almost the whole country became a prison. But they had, you know, people were just sent to prison for the slightest little thing. And they were beaten. They were starved. They were just, you know, treated so inhumanely. But you read the life of Stalin, and here's a man who became more and more paranoid, you know, with every passing day, because he was always worried that somebody was going to try to take his job. And so he was having what they call purges, where he'd have everybody around him killed, and then they would be replaced, and then he'd have his food tested all the time, and then, you know, just driving down the road, he'd have this very elaborate kind of ballet where he'd have about five or six different cars that all look the same. They'd all have their windows kind of blacked out or tinted out, and they'd do this ballet going down the road so nobody knew what car Stalin was in. He was always afraid for his life because he was such a murderous tyrant that he knew he was a marked man. You know what I'm saying? What kind of life is that? But you see these people, you look at them, Mao Zedong, you look at Castro, you look at all these dictators, even Saddam Hussein. You know, you think, well, these people have all the power, and they do. This is what we're reading here. They're making other people's lives absolutely, totally miserable. But these people who are tenaciously hanging on to their power, very often their lives are totally miserable too. And they've got no one to comfort them. And this is what he's talking about. And I really think there's a lot of truth to that, especially when, you know, these dictators want nothing to do with God. Then where do they turn? And you look at their lives. Their lives are so fleeting, and they do everything they can to hold on to this power, to this position, to this fame, to this whatever it is that they're grasping for. And it's so fleeting. It's here today, and it's gone tomorrow. And these guys are burning in hell now. You know, what did they accomplish? It was Jesus who said, "What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world, loses his own soul?" You know what I'm saying? So if you look at what's going on in the world today, most people in the world today live under oppression. We don't see it in this country, but I'm telling you right now, the handwriting's on the wall, and it's coming. All right? And so he says here, so he's evaluating this, and then he says in verse 2, he says, "So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living." Well, let's face it. You read about some of these horrible things that the Nazis did, to not just to the Jews, they did it to the Gypsies, they did it to the Christians, they did it to all kinds of different people. I mean, they would experiment on them. I mean, for example, with Hitler and under his regime, they had all kinds of experiments on people. They would take people and they'd put them into planes with no oxygen mask or anything like that. They'd take them up to extremely high altitudes to see how far they could go up until they killed them. Because they'd say, well, we needed this information for our pilots. Or they'd have other people drink nothing but seawater until it killed them. They say, well, we needed this information for our sailors. And then they have other people be naked in the snow, you know, and see how long it takes to last before dying of hypothermia. I mean, this is what happens when people begin to oppress other people. And when you're in a situation when you are being tortured and tormented by oppressors, I mean, death looks more inviting than life. And that's what Solomon's saying here. I mean, you know, there's so many people who have been through such, you know, the mental, emotional, spiritual agonies that are damned under their oppressors that they wish they were dead. This is what Solomon is saying. He's always saying, oh, I congratulate the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living, but better off than both of them is the one who had never existed, who had never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. Now, he's talking about here the stillbirths, people who, you know, I mean, children who are born dead or never make it, you know, to see the sunlight. He says that, in a sense, these are really fortunate ones because they've never lived to see the evil done under the sun. Well, it does sound very, very pessimistic. But if you look at, for example, Job, he got to this point in his life where, you know, when God tested him, I mean, he went through such incredible pain. I mean, stop and think about the suffering that he went through, right? I mean, he was in a situation where he lost all of his children. Then everything he owned was stolen, everything. Then Satan ups the ante, where God says, okay, you can touch his body, you can't take his life. And then he's ended up having these gross boils on him. He got to the point where he was sitting in a garbage dump. Having lost everything, and you're sitting there scraping your boils off with a broken piece of pottery, and you're talking about getting down to the absolute depths of despair. Well, he got to that point. He got to that point where, rather than curse God, he cursed the day that he was born. He cursed the day that he was conceived. He wished that he had never seen the sun. Well, that's what happens to a lot of people who experience a great deal of suffering. So that's where Solomon is coming from here. He's saying that, man, you know, there's so much evil in the world, and there's so much oppression, and there's so much suffering, there's so much pain. He concluded that it's better off never to come into this life or never to see the sun at all. But again, you're only looking at it from a horizontal perspective, all right? I mean, how many people have said this kind of thing? Well, I don't want to have children. I don't want to bring in this world because there's so much pain and suffering or whatever. But we got to look beyond that. We really do. Because people, when they're only looking at the here and now, then the greatest evil in the world is suffering. But if we look at it from a vertical perspective, if we look at it from a divine perspective, what is the greatest evil in the world?
Sin.
Sin. Why? It's an offense against God. But if you got to carry this to its ultimate logical conclusion, if there was no sin, there'd be no suffering. In other words, we have to look at it from a different angle. If we just look at it from the here and now, then Solomon's right. All right, it's better never to be born and see all the evil in the world and experience that. But look what God does with suffering. I mean, suffering is something that God will use in our life to fashion us, to shape us, to mold us, to build us, to draw us closer to Him. I've said this so many times, and it's so true, that imagine your life without any pain, without any suffering. Imagine it having unlimited funds, that you can have everything you wanted. And I don't think it takes a whole lot of insight to be able to discern it. Well, if your life was like that, first of all, you'd be a very shallow person. Second of all, you would have no real dependency on God, or feeling of dependency upon God. Or you'd really have no desire for God, or no interest in God, no interest in the things of God. You know, because you, in a sense, you become self-sufficient. You become independent. You become autonomous from Him. You know, but this is what God will often do in a person's life. He will bring suffering and pain and heartbreak and disillusionment and setback and disappointments into a person's life for the very purpose of developing that person, of deepening that person. You see what I'm saying? I mean, a person who's never gone through a lot of suffering in their life very often is a very shallow person. A person who's gone through a great deal of suffering in their life very often becomes a very deep person. They have a totally different perspective. And a lot of times suffering will drive us to God. It will bring us to a point where we will come into a deeper understanding of Him and His ways and of His Word. So God will take suffering and He will use it for His glory and for His honor and to really deepen us as human beings. All right, but if you're only going to look at the here and now, then Solomon's right. It's what he's saying here. And then he says here in that verse 4, says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. What motivates men to make money and more money and more money and make more money with more money and more money with more money? There's a great deal of competitiveness. There's a great deal of envy. There's a great deal of covetousness, which drives men to do what? To try to accumulate as much money or wealth or popularity or power or fame or whatever, right? But he says this is all emptiness. This is all vanity. Stop and think about it for a second. Let me just ask something. Let me ask you, and you got to be honest with yourself. Let's just say that you go buy a lottery ticket, all right? And then the person behind you buys the lottery ticket. You come to find out that this other person won the lottery, all right? Even if it's your best friend, what's going to be your reaction, in all honesty, more than likely?
How come that couldn't have been me?
Yeah.
Jealousy.
Right. You see what I'm saying? I mean, if you're really honest with yourself, you got to say, you know, that very often is the case. You see, a lot of times it's very, very easy to, let's say, be compassionate or sympathetic or caring or concerned when a friend of yours or somebody you know is hurting or going through difficult times. But if that same friend or acquaintance of yours all of a sudden comes into a great deal of wealth or, you know, a great deal of blessing, a lot of times people can't accept that the same way. In other words, there's something within us that fails to rejoice in another person's blessing because we feel like somehow it's diminished our blessing. See what I'm saying? This is what Solomon is basically standing back and looking at. I think it's a rare person who can really rejoice and be happy over the good fortune of another person. I think that's what Solomon's looking at here. What he's saying here, I think, has a lot of weight to it. I really do. When he says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done under the sun of rivalry between a man and his neighbor is to his vanity. But look what, for example, we're talking about people who accumulate a great deal of money. Look at Howard Hughes. You know, he was worth over $1 billion. But look what he did with his money. In other words, he was a man who became incredibly wealthy. There's no way he could spend all of his money. But he became more and more of a recluse where he began to shut himself off from the world around him. And he developed a real phobia for germs and bugs. He didn't take a shower, let his hair grow, let his beard grow, let his fingernails grow. And he would just sit in his room day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. You know, and he just wasted away his life. So here was a man who had a tremendous potential to do good. And what did he do? What did he do with what he had in his life? It just basically consumed him because, you know, I think this is all his focus was on, was the here and now and money and making more money with more money, and then it led him down this dead end. And then his whole life became a total waste. He says in verse 5, it says, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. You know, that is very self-explanatory, but in a sense, we look around, and I see a lot of people like this today. It says, a fool folds his own hand and consumes his own flesh. You know what that means, basically? A lazy person is his own worst enemy. You know what it says in the New Testament? Paul says, he who will not work, neither let him eat. Now, he didn't say he who cannot work. He said, he who will not work, neither let him eat. You know what? We have this welfare program going on. It completely destroys a person's incentive to make anything out of their life. People, when they stand before God, one of the sins that I think is going to loom the largest on Judgment Day is the sins of omission. The fact that, you know, that people have done virtually nothing with the life that God has given them, with the resources He's given them, with the talents they've given them, and what have they done with it? Or the opportunities that God has given them are put in their way, and they don't take advantage of it. Hey, you know, people are really going to have to account to God for, you know, what they didn't do in life, not just what they did. And, you know, Solomon says also, I say in the Proverbs, says a little more sleep, a little more slumber, a little more folding of the hands, and your poverty will break in on you like an armed bandit. Little incremental steps at a time, and what happens to your life?
you can ruin it, making the wrong choices, poor choices, doing the wrong thing. And I'm telling you, all you have to do is just sit down in front of the TV 56 hours a week, you know, and I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen to you. It says, a fool folds his hands and consumes his own life. You're going to destroy your life, and you're going to have to count to God for it. And in verse 6, it says, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. What does he mean by that?
Better to be content with what you have than striving after more and more and more.
Good, good. It says one hand full of rest is better than two fists of labor striving after the wind. In other words, you know, you're right. You know, if you can be content with what you have, all right, but also we have to work for what we have, but at the same token, there's something to be said about having a balance in your life. And this is what he's talking about here, too. You know, but you're right as far as this whole concept of being able to enjoy your life. It says in verse 7, it says, then I looked again at vanity under the sun. It says, there was a certain man without a descendant, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all of his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity and a grievous task. Or, you know, it was almost depressing when he talked about a grievous task. You know what he's saying in essence? He's saying he observed that there was a guy. He didn't have a family, didn't have a wife, didn't have any children, didn't have any brothers, didn't have any sisters, didn't have any, you know, close relatives. But he spent his life constantly work to make more and more money. And for what? Solomon says, this is vanity, this is emptiness, this is meaningless, this is futile, this is stupid, this is really asinine. In other words, the guy's entire ambition in life was to just go out there and make as much money as he can. You ever see that bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys wins? I mean, this was his mentality, right? To collect as much stuff as he possibly can, but he had nobody even to leave it to. Like I said, you look at Howard Hughes, you know what happened to his money? He had over $1 billion worth. You know what happened to it? You know, lawyers all sucked it up. You know, they all fought over it and got it all. You know what I mean? So what did it profit him? You know, I mean, this is what he's talking about here. I think what needs to be said about this is what Paul talked about in the New Testament. You know, learning the secret of being content. He said, I've learned the secret, whether I have little or whether I have much, whether I'm hungry, whether I'm full. Whatever the situation that he found himself in, he learned that secret of being content. Read this again. He says, there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all of his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. You know what Jesus said? He talked about having your spiritual life choked out by the deceitfulness of riches. Remember, he gave the parable of the sower and the seed, and he said some of the seed fell among thorns and thistles. And he said these thorns and thistles represented the cares and the worries of the world, but he also said it represented the deceitfulness of riches. What does he mean by the deceitfulness of riches? It's this.
You get it? It's not what you thought it would be?
Good. In other words, I think it was Rockefeller, you know, one of the multimillionaires, one of the richest men in the world. Somebody asked him, how much money does it take to satisfy a man? And he says, just a little bit more than he has. You see, the richest man in the world is still going to want to get more. That's the deceitfulness of riches, is that you can get on this proverbial, a treadmill, or in other words, or be chasing after this proverbial carrot, thinking that if I just get this, I'll be happy, I'll be complete, I'll be fulfilled, my life will be what I want it to be. But it's all, you know, an illusion. Because why? It says here, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. Isn't that what we read in, I think it was the very first chapter, when he talked about vanity of vanity? It says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. All things are wearisome, man isn't able to tell it. In other words, you know, we're never going to be satisfied if we're only living in the here and now. You know, we got to recognize there's something much more to life than just that. Like Augustine says, the heart is restless, O Lord, until it rests in thee. You know, we got to really look to God for our meaning, for our purpose, for our happiness, and for contentment.
It's like what you're saying, when even the richest man in the world, if he can just get a little bit more money, you know, he'll be happy and content. So it's like he's never happy.
Right.
And it's like he's always looking
right.
for another way to be happier. But, you know, right. they get more. And it's, you know, it's God, but he doesn't know that.
Right. Right.
He's never going to find his happiness.
Right.
No matter how much money he gets.
Yeah. But you know what? We don't read it in this chapter here. But no less than six times, Solomon ends up concluding, when he looks at life and he looks at all of these different things, he concluded that the best thing for a man to do in life is to enjoy his food, enjoy his drink, enjoy his labor, and enjoy, you know, the wife of his youth. In other words, hey, live in the present, all right? Live in the present, and in terms of enjoying what God has given you now. Take a very simple thing, very simple thing. I mean, you know, if I'm drinking a cold glass of water, I'll be thanking God with every swallow. Because it, even though it's something that's very, very ordinary, that you just take for granted, you don't even think about, I'm telling you, you go 2-3 days without water, and you will really, that's all you will think about. You know, it's a simple thing that we just take so much for granted because it seems so ordinary. But this ordinary thing, if we can really begin to appreciate what we have, you know, we can enjoy it. We really can enjoy it to its fullest. Same thing with a meal. I mean, I get really, really fed up with Americans, and I see it all the time, is with the realization that you got, you know, millions upon millions of people that are suffering from malnutrition and dying of starvation, living in abject poverty, you know, and then you see Americans have an idea, you know, they say, oh, we got to eat this again, this is leftovers, or people, they'll come in the store and say, oh, I just hate shopping because you got to put this away, and I'm thinking, hey, don't you know how lucky you are to be able to even have these groceries? Don't let it go over your head. Don't take it for granted. Enjoy it. Enjoy it right now. In other words, live in the present and be grateful to God for what he's given you right now. Don't live in the future. Don't live in the past. Sure, you can plan for the future and you can learn from the past. But in other words, seize the moment. I've said this so many times in my life. Seize the moment. What are you doing right now to make the most of the opportunity you have right now? Just seize it. Grab it. Don't let it go. Don't let it fade away from you. I'm saying it's good to have your goals. It's good to have, you know, ambition in life. But everything needs to be centered in Christ. Everything needs to be centered in what does God want me to do with my life? You know, to trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. And then seize the moment. Grab it for everything it's worth. And then he says here in that verse 9, it says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either one of them falls, the other will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Now, this is pretty self-explanatory in many ways, and you can make all kinds of applications to this. But he's basically saying this. Two people working together are going to accomplish twice as much as one. That's the foregone conclusion. But then take this to a spiritual level too, in a sense. You know, the Bible talks about, hey, forsake not gathering with the saints as is the habit of some. In other words, hey, we need each other. We need the fellowship. You know, it's good to get along with God. It's good to read his word alone. I encourage that every single day. I encourage people to do that. But you also need to be around like-minded people. All right? Because if you can share Christ together, your bond will be strengthened in him and in each other. And if you have that kind of fellowship together, then if one of you have a struggle, the other one's there to pick him up. You know, the other one's there to encourage him. And what it says here that a cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart, what did Jesus say? You know, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of you. I mean, this is where we derive our strength. I'm talking about spiritual strength. Yeah, which?
I also see it as like two Christians bound with God.
Right.
And that's why it can be torn apart, because they're bound with God. That's the third.
Right. Okay. Well, like I said, there's a lot of applications you can make it. You can make it with marriage. You can make it, you know, in your Christian walk. And there's a lot of different other applications. But, you know, he also says here, he says, furthermore, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? That's kind of significant. I think it's kind of interesting. Jesus is the one who says, in the last days, the love of many will grow cold. Because what? Because wickedness will abound. That's why, you know, I think that in the midst of an evil, perverse generation like we're living in today, you know, we really do need to go to fellowship. We really do need to go to prayer meetings and go to church and go to Bible study. And not just as individuals, but collectively, because that's the only way we're going to keep each other warm, you know. And then he says here in that verse 14, it says, back at the verse 13, A poor yet wise lad is better than an old foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instructions. That's pretty self-explanatory. A poor and wise lad. In other words, you know, Solomon talks about again and again and again how wisdom exceeds foolishness, like light exceeds darkness. And he's talking about here, if a person is in a position of power, but he's a fool, you know, there's more hope for a person who's poor but has wisdom. There's no comparison, right, to wisdom and foolishness. And so he says, in verse 14, he says, "For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all those who were before them, and even the ones who come later will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity and striving after the wind." Now what he's saying here, you need to basically take 13, 14, 15, 16 together to see the whole context of what he's talking about. And what he's talking about is basically this. So often you can see through history, and we can see it today too, I mean, you know, and time and time again, you see it where people get fed up with their leader, okay, the person that, over them, and they will have him overthrown or replaced by somebody new, by somebody younger, and who makes them all kinds of promises of what they're going to do to improve the whole their whole life and everything else. But then, he says, another generation comes along, and they don't like this guy, you know, that you put in. So they kick him out. And the same thing, he says, it just keeps repeating itself over and over and over and over again. And these people that go from total obscurity and to become really influential people, really powerful people, wealthy people, whatever, says, hey, in the end, they're going to be replaced. People are going to get tired of them. So he just keeps moving on. It's just like this endless cycle. So here's the thing, all right? You got to look at life from a different perspective. This is what Solomon basically is trying to point out to us. Is that if this all there is to life is just this endless cycle, all right, then it's all vanity. It's all meaningless. It's all purposeless. There's no point to it. But once you put God in the equation, you put God in the mix, you put him where he belongs, you know, not only does everything fall into place and everything begin to make sense, but your whole life takes on purpose and hope and meaning. It boils down to like what Augustine said, a man's heart is restless, O Lord, until it rests in thee. All right? In other words, stop and think just for a minute as a closing thought. What do you think is going to make you happiest in life? Just stop and think. What would make you happiest? All right? Would it be money? I don't care. Would it be health? Would it be a wife? Would it be whatever? All right? And you could throw everything in you want. Think of everything you can imagine that's going to make you happy. All right? And if God's not in the equation, I guarantee you, you're not going to be happy. You're just not. You're not going to be fulfilled. You're not going to be complete. And I'm not saying if you have God in your life, you're not going to have any troubles. You know, on the contrary, you're going to experience all kinds of troubles. But it's going to be a totally different perspective in your life. And you're going to see that whatever you're going through has a purpose, has a meaning to it, because God is the center of your life. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?